Immediately following the September 11th attacks on the United States, the government began its so-called War on Terror. And this war started at home. Thousands of people were apprehended, mostly Muslim non-citizens from Arab and South Asian countries, and they were kept in confinement even though there was no prior evidence of any alleged terrorist activities. In 2002, the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York filed a civil rights lawsuit on behalf of hundreds of these people. Matthew Strugar is an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, and he joins me now by phone. Good morning, and thank you for joining us, Matthew.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Who specifically was subject to investigation and detention immediately following September 11th?
Well, it seems that immediately following September 11th, there were massive disappearances that were going on in the Brooklyn and New Jersey area. We were getting calls from organizations such as the Islamic Circle in North America and CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, that people were just disappearing and their families and their friends had no idea where they were going. And these were all, you know, generally Arab or Muslim men or people who were perceived to be Arab or Muslim men. There are sometimes, you know, Hindus, you know, people of Indian background, etc., that were just disappearing, and no one really knew what was happening to them. You know, they would call various, you know, detention centers and things like that, and they couldn't find anybody. What turns out happens was the FBI was, you know, in pursuing this intense investigation around the September 11th attacks, and they had these tip lines set up in this bombing investigation, and their net was cast very widely, and they were taking tips such as there's too many Arab men working at the grocery store down the street. There's no need for so many people working in one store, or the Arab guys down the hall are up all hours of the night. I'm suspicious, and things like that. And they were acting on those tips to go investigate people. And they would go talk to people. They'd talk to them about their immigration status. And if they found that anyone was out of status, they would detain them and hold them, you know, for violating, you know, under the auspices of violating the immigration code, to hold them in preventative detention for extremely long periods of time, far longer than needed to, you know, carry out their removal from this country, far longer than the previous regulations allowed. It was usually 90 days. Some of these people were then held for up to 6 months. And they were pretty much, they abused the leniency in the immigration, the Bush administration abused the leniency in the immigration code to, you know, in this country it's civil, it's not a criminal thing, so our criminal protections do not apply, and they abused the leniency in that to investigate these people for ties to terrorism, and pretty much innocent until proven guilty was turned on its head, and these individuals were forced to prove that they had no connection to the September 11th attacks, even though there was no evidence of anything, any wrongdoing on their parts except their race.
There was a saying in Northern Ireland that if you were British justice was innocent until proven Irish.
Right.
And I guess this is innocent until proven Muslim.
Right.
Under what conditions were these people held?
Well, people were held at a number of different facilities, but the one that our lawsuit mostly deals with, we have individuals at two different facilities, but the one that has been subject to the sort of most public criticism has been the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York. And those conditions were horrific, actually. They were held we call it the Administrative Maximum Special Housing Unit that was built right after this to hold, you know, individuals they thought were suspected of being part of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And these people were held in solitary confinement. They were, you know, all six of our plaintiffs from the MDC, our named plaintiffs, this is a class action, but all six of our named plaintiffs were subject to, you know, brutal instances of excessive force, heads slammed into walls, and they lost teeth, and instances, you know, just terrible, terrible physical abuse. The lights were on 24 hours a day. They blasted the air conditioning in the winter. They blasted the heat in the summer. They were denied recreation. They were subject to a communications blackout where they were not allowed to make any legal calls to any attorneys, to any family members. And if anyone called these facilities, like I said earlier, if anybody called the facilities asking where they were told that they didn't have those individuals. Attorneys would call and say, you know, I have reason to believe my client might be there. And they would say, no, we don't have anyone by that name. There was just a total communications blackout ordered from, we think, the highest levels of government to just not let these people contact the outside world.
And were they interrogated under these conditions, or were they simply tormented?
They were interrogated. They were brought before, you know, a couple of different FBI interviews while they were there. It seems like they would be brought down to a different floor, so it wasn't exactly on, you know, the floor where they were being tormented, but they were still, you know, subject to, you know, four-point holds with both, you know, leg shackles and arm shackles and waist chains and all that kind of thing. And, yeah, and they were interrogated in those conditions.
So if people are presumed, as it seems, treated as though they're already guilty of terrorism, there's no evidence, how can a person prove themselves innocent?
That's a good question. I mean, that's why we have innocent until proven guilty. It seems as though what happened here was, you know, they would go through things like address books and things like that and, you know, go after every number and every name. And but even then, it seems like it wouldn't take 6 months to track down all this person's contacts and realize that they have absolutely nothing to do with anything. It seems that there was also just a lot of bureaucracy and ineptitude involved here, where clearances were supposed to take, you know, only a couple of weeks, actually ended up taking months, and a lot of interagency fighting over the time that was going on. There was the Office of Inspector General of the United States Department of Justice did an investigation into these roundups and into the conditions at the MDC. And we usually, at the Center for Constitutional Rights, we usually expect those to be a whitewash, but this was actually a very thorough and good investigation, and it backed up a lot of our allegations. And they found, they interviewed high-level government officials, which we haven't really had the opportunity to do in our lawsuit yet, and they found that, you know, they backed up these communications blackout and hold-until-cleared policies and said that there was a lot of interagency fighting and that the INS wanted something that the FBI didn't, and that the reason these people were just held in these brutal conditions for months and months a lot of times just seemed to be bureaucracy and ineptitude.
Could you explain the lawsuit that the Center for Constitutional Rights initiated and filed in 2002?
Sure, yeah. In April 2002, we filed a civil rights class action on behalf of eight individuals, six that were held at the MDC and two that were held at the Passaic County Jail in New Jersey, where the conditions weren't quite as bad, but they were still pretty awful.
You mentioned earlier this was a class action, so though the numbers that you're listing are specific people that are small, they're on behalf of hundreds of people.
Yes, our class is actually people that were picked up in New Jersey and New York and held at those two facilities, which we believe numbers approximately 475 individuals. It seems as though there were far more than that picked up all around the country, but because of the way, you know, the legal system, you know, they won't let you do these unwieldy class actions a lot of the time. We had to sort of narrow it. So our lawsuit will cover 475 individuals, but it is on behalf of eight named plaintiffs. And we allege some 30 causes of action here, but our main argument is that the government is not really allowed to use the leniency of the Immigration Code to abuse their power and to take criminal protections away from somebody and conduct a criminal investigation of someone under the Immigration Code. We're saying that, you know, under the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, this was a search and seizure, or more specifically a seizure of them, that was unlawful, and that they were held beyond what it took to effectuate their removal, and that is unconstitutional. And, you know, that is our main claim, that's our main argument in this case. And then above and beyond that, we have a lot of claims regarding, you know, obviously the conditions that they were held in, the excessive force and the arbitrary and punitive strip searching and the inability to practice their religion. Whenever our plaintiffs tried to pray, guards would come by and slam on their doors and curse at them and insult their religion and not let them pray. You know, people would try to pray loudly so that other people could hear them. You know, the one person would lead the prayer and then there would be a response. And the guards tried to make enough noise to not let people do that. And also, you know, the same kind of banging when people try to sleep and the lights on 24 hours a day. So we have a lot of sort of conditions of confinement claims, First Amendment, you know, inability to access counsel or family members kind of claims, and then as well as international law claims.
And where does the lawsuit stand at present?
Well, we've been allowed to proceed. It's interesting because it's been what, you know, 3.5 years now since we filed this case. And, you know, it normally doesn't take that long to get to as slow. It's normally not as slow as it's been in this case. And we have been allowed to proceed against the individual guards at the MDC under the theory that this is pretty much, at least those parts are pretty much any, it's not that controversial. It's a pretty much a, you know, a prison abuse case in a sense. Regarding our claims against high-level Bush administration officials, we still have a motion to dismiss, or the government still has a motion to dismiss pending before the judge that he's been sitting on for a long time. We expect a ruling in that any day. There is also a companion case to ours involving two individuals who were picked up on minor criminal investigations. They're not involved in our class because they weren't, you know, immigration violators. They had, like, you know, very minor criminal things that would have landed them in jail for, you know, a couple days until they could see a judge, and then they were held for 6 months instead. And they actually, it's before the same judge, and we work with them on their case as well. And they received a ruling 2 weeks ago, and it was very positive. They're allowed to keep Ashcroft on the hook. Ashcroft is going to have to testify about what his role was in all this, as well as FBI Director Mueller and former INS Director James Ziegler, about what role they had in this and what they knew and what they didn't know. You know, they were alleging that they didn't have to be involved in this case because, you know, they're high-level government officials and there's immunity and all these other things. And usually that actually happens. But the judge stepped up and did the right thing in this case and said they at least have to come forward and say what they knew and what they didn't to see if they can still stay on the hook. So we expect a ruling at least as good as theirs. They do not have the immigration claims that are at the heart of our lawsuit. So we could still have a partial victory and not a total one, but we think the judge is smart, and we're hoping a ruling soon, and we're hoping we expect to win on more than we lose on.
I know this isn't exactly a legal, but more a kind of political question. Do you have the sense that with the shifting popular opinion with regards to the war and the acknowledgement of the lies that preceded it and so forth, that within the judiciary itself there's an increased willingness to look at these issues more carefully and rather than simply under the pressure of the political will of the administration?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, I think this sort of idea, at least in this country, that, you know, the judiciary is sort of this detached, neutral arbitrator, you know, someone that strictly interprets the law, as the Bush administration likes to say. I think that's, you know, kind of a joke. Anybody's, you know, subject to the shifting political winds to some extent. Our judge was a Clinton appointee, and he seems to be, from what we've heard, a very smart and fair guy. So, we haven't been as worried about those kind of things in our cases. We might be with another judge. But I hope in general that the judiciary is willing to step up now that they can see that, you know, this sent the war on lies, and they seem to be able to do anything they want to sort of lead this country where they want it to go.
Meantime, what's happened to the individuals that you're representing in the lawsuit?
They've all been removed to the home countries. We have three Canadian individuals, actually, in the Toronto area. Some have been removed to Egypt and Reunion Island and other places. A lot of them, when they went back to their home countries, they were detained there and interviewed by their government. And they say that it's the fact that the U.S. investigated them for ties to terrorism has followed them to their countries and made work hard. A lot of these individuals suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. They can't really function. Some people have been told, you know, are getting disability because they're not able to concentrate and function. Some people have put their lives back together, and they're getting on. And they, you know, we have two individuals who own a business now in Egypt and are getting on with their lives. But it's something that continues to follow all eight of the people that I talk to.
Once stigmatized as a terrorist suspect, I guess, with repressive governments around the world, it reverberates and reverberates.
Right.
Is this case being supported by the legal case and the legal work the Center of Constitutional Rights is doing, supported by larger social movements which are trying to prevent further arbitrary detentions of the type that you're acting on behalf of?
Well, the Center for Constitutional Rights generally tries to get to do cases that will support movements. That's instead of there's, you know, other progressive legal organizations that will file a case and then try to sort of get a movement around it. We try to have the movement part first and file the lawsuit that will support them. And this case actually came to us from Islamic Circle of North America and Council on Islamic Relations. But unfortunately, there's not. It's hard to really get a huge it's hard to get a movement around this case because the individuals who were directly affected, who can kind of tell their stories, have been removed from the country, and they're not allowed back in for 5 to 10 years. And I think the population who is at risk of this happening again, if there's another large-scale terrorist attack, which is the whole point of this case, is to make sure that this doesn't happen again, that they can't abuse the immigration code in this way. I think a lot of the community is actually, you know, is still a little scared to sort of organize around this. I think the Muslim community in this country is sort of on its heels and is afraid to sort of really speak up, and they don't have a lot of support from a lot of other, a lot of other parts of American society, unfortunately.
Well, thanks for speaking with us this morning, and we hope you have your success with the case that you're fighting.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye, Matthew.
Bye.
I've been speaking with Matthew Strugar with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, and you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial.